You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a closer look at a growing trend of black women playing therapists on popular TV shows. We'll discuss what it means for the representation of black women in pop culture and what our guest says is a trend. First, a new report from the group Clean Wisconsin says the future Foxconn plant in Mount Pleasant would be a major new source of air pollution in southeastern Wisconsin. That's based on a review they did of the company's air pollution permits filed with the state DNR. Construction is scheduled to start in the next couple of months, and the plant would be a major new source of employment in that area, with as many as 13,000 jobs expected by the time it's up and fully running. The findings come after more bad news for the region's air quality, with the EPA saying last December that nine counties in the southeastern part of the state are violating the agency's stricter ozone regulations. Tracy Holloway is an air quality expert. She's a professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison. She's with us now to talk about what this all means for the communities and the environment near that proposed facility. Tracy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, a lot to untangle here. But first of all, looking at this comparison of pollution that theoretically would come from this plant versus other plants in the area, how would this Foxconn plant, from their applications, kind of stack up?
Yeah, this would be a big facility. The way that it works is that any new industrial facility applies to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources for an air permit. And they have to say, this is what chemicals we expect to come out. This is how much of each of those chemicals. And then they usually work with a consulting company to estimate what the impact would be on the air that people are actually breathing in. Because what you're actually breathing in depends on what's coming out of the plant, how it reacts in the atmosphere with other chemicals, how weather conditions affect what's moving around, and then finally what's at the nose level of communities nearby.
And one of the big emissions, or I guess consequences of emissions, that is part of the story with Foxconn and with these EPA regulations and with the weather patterns is ozone. And I want to talk about ozone a little. Now, a plant like this or a power plant doesn't shoot ozone directly into the environment. What's the chain here?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There are two main ingredients to form ozone. One are nitrogen oxides. And for those folks who are thinking about chemicals specifically, that's nitrogen oxide, NO, and nitrogen dioxide, NO2. So those two together form NOx. And that's one ingredient. The other ingredient is a group of chemicals called volatile organic compounds. People have had the most experience with these if they've painted their house and have the no VOC or low VOC paint, doesn't smell as much. These same VOCs come off of when you fill up your car at the gas tank, anything that is smelly. In fact, even pine trees emit VOCs. So there's a lot of both natural and man-made VOCs. And the VOCs, the NOx, they cook up together on hot summer days to form ozone.
And ozone is good in some places. We like having an ozone layer way up there. Why do we worry about ozone when it's down here?
Yeah, so with ozone, sometimes we say good up high, bad nearby. It is a reactive chemical that reacts with lungs and other tissue. It degrades crop yields. It can even degrade rubber. So it's a very reactive chemical. And that is true everywhere. It's just that none of us are living way up high in the stratosphere. We're all living down at the ground. So when it's high up in the stratosphere, the ozone layer, it acts like a natural sunblock. But just like you wouldn't drink sunblock, you don't necessarily want to breathe in ozone. And so that's why we control ozone near the surface, where it is not naturally occurring in high quantities, but rather formed through these ingredients.
And now let's get into the EPA's ozone limits. What's going on in southeastern Wisconsin, and what's going on with those federal regulations?
Yeah, so ever since 1970, the federal government has had a limit of what is considered a safe level of ozone. And as we learn more from the public health research and have more data on what people are actually breathing, over time, the EPA has made those limits tighter and tighter and tighter. And in many ways, this is a good news story. What used to be everyday ozone in Los Angeles was super unhealthy, and now it's getting cleaner and cleaner everywhere. It's getting much cleaner here in southeast Wisconsin. But we still see health impacts. There's an almost linear relationship between the ozone in the air and the number of people who check into the hospital with asthma, for example. There's other health outcomes, too. But the problem is that, you know, this pass-fail system that the EPA has set up means that every county in every state has to show whether they are passing or failing this standard. And recently, in late 2015, the standard was lowered. It was tightened from 75 parts per billion to 70 parts per billion. And this change makes a big difference because a lot of counties along the Wisconsin lakeshore are just in that low 70s range. So a county that used to be passing may be failing under the new standard.
And Wisconsin is asking the federal government for a waiver, right, from those restrictions, in part saying, okay, yeah, maybe the ozone's there. It's coming from Illinois and Indiana, at least in part.
Yeah, this is a dance that every state does with the EPA on a regular basis. And it's very similar to a teacher who asks students to calculate their own grade. And the students come back and say, well, this is what we think should happen. And then the teacher says, well, I've looked at the data too, and I don't think you're quite right. And what happened is that between 2016 and 2017, the state said that they thought that they were passing on the ozone standard everywhere. And then in late 2017, the EPA came back and said, no, we think you're failing in Racine County and in many counties around Milwaukee and other places. And now the Wisconsin has challenged that and said, no, we really do think we're passing. And at this point, this dance is still going on, and we don't know what the final judgment will be from the EPA.
Talking to Tracy Holloway from the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, looking at ozone pollution and other air pollutants and the new proposed, likely to happen now, Foxconn plant. And let's bring this back home, now that we've got all those pieces in place, to Foxconn. Looking at the amount of ozone precursors, I guess we'd call them, that they might emit, is this a drop in the bucket compared to what's there now, or is this a significant difference potentially?
Yeah, this would be a very big source. It would be the largest source of VOCs in southeastern Wisconsin. And it would also be a large source of NOx and a source of other pollutants, too. So computer modeling from Foxconn's own permit request suggested that it would increase ozone about 0.77 parts per billion. So in the order of about 1% of the standard. And I'll say that I saw that in their permit. I haven't, of course, dug into the details. And so my question is, what would that mean on the hottest summer days? And I think I don't know the answer.
Right. So, and that's part of the concern. We can say over the course of a year, how much is ozone increased? But if those asthma attacks go up a lot in a day when there's a high ozone level, and that can really depend on weather and climate.
Absolutely. And the ozone is the highest on the hottest summer days. And on these days, often winds are pretty low and the sun is shining bright. And this is just the perfect recipe to cook up ozone. And there's this question about how much ozone is from a particular county, how much is from the rest of the state, the region, how much even can we trace to other parts of the world like China? And the breakdown of local, regional, global sources really changes day to day. And this is such an active question in the counties near Milwaukee that just last summer, NASA and the National Science Foundation funded a huge campaign where they took aircraft and boats and scientists from all over the country converging on Milwaukee to study the ozone. So this is really not something that is an easy question.
And when a company applies for this air quality permit, is it just a yes or no, or is it a yes if or no but? What are the options here?
You know, it's a very good question, and there's a lot of discretion at the state level. The federal EPA lays out the limits, but, you know, each state is responsible for managing its own air quality and figuring out how to issue permits in a way that complies with the federal law. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of layers to it. And at this point, the Foxconn facility has submitted 4 separate permits. And I think there's still another permit that has not yet been submitted. So we don't have the full picture, even with the hundreds and hundreds of pages of permitting that has already been submitted.
And we've focused on ozone a lot. What other possible emissions would we be focused on here?
Yeah, well, the nitrogen oxides that are an ingredient to ozone have direct health impacts themselves, and also nitrogen oxides react to form fine particulates in the atmosphere. And these fine particulates have been associated with respiratory disease, heart disease, and decreased life expectancy. So, you know, there's this cocktail of chemicals coming out of any new source. And really the question is, what technologies are going to be required to reduce the pollutants? And to your question of, is it yes or no? No, it's not, I realized. Really, the question is, what technologies is a facility going to be required to apply?
Do we gain more from really focusing on a new facility like this Foxconn plant, or are there easier pickings, lower hanging fruit in, say, existing, I don't know, power plants or factories?
Well, new facilities are in a position to make a choice. Do you want to invest in the cleanest technologies, the medium technologies, or the not so clean technologies? They have to buy something. And the question is, what are they going to buy? When you have an older facility, of course, you can upgrade it, but it can be more expensive to upgrade an old facility. So typically, new sources are held to more stringent air quality standards and expectations than older industries and facilities.
We'll leave it there for now. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
Tracy Holloway is a professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, where she leads an air quality research program. She was with us to talk about air pollution in southeastern Wisconsin and how the new Foxconn facility may contribute to that. A lot of data in their air quality permit applications with the state. First, if you watch a lot of TV, you might have spotted a trend, more black women playing the role of therapists in some of your favorite shows. From programs like My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend with actress Rachel Bloom to Mr. Robot on the USA Network, our next guest says she has seen that trend. Here's a scene from the FX show You're the Worst. It's about two self-destructive people who fall in love. In this clip, actress Aya Cash has tracked down her therapist at a cafe and interrupted her eating lunch. The therapist is played by Samira Wiley, who you might know from The Handmaid's Tale or Orange is the New Black.
So you remember Jimmy, right?
Oh my God. Gretchen.
Anyway, I have to have this really sucky conversation with him, and I don't want to at all.
Your appointment isn't until next week. You cannot just show up places.
Well, then stop foursquaring yourself every time you leave the house like the mayor of Thirsty Town. Also, stop using Foursquare like the mayor of 2011.
Aisha Harris is a culture writer for Slate and host of Slate's podcast Represent. Aisha, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
When did you first start noticing this pattern of the black female therapist in pop culture?
Well, I watch a lot of TV and movies as part of my job, obviously. And I think the first time it clicked was actually recently in the last few months when I was watching the latest season of Grace and Frankie. And Grace and Frankie is a Netflix show, really funny, stars both Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. But there's one moment in the latest season where two of the characters who actually play those characters, Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda's ex-husbands who are now married to each other, they are trying to figure out what it's like to now be these older gay men and these older gay married men. And they go to see a therapist, a marriage counselor, and that marriage counselor is played by Lorraine Toussaint. And Lorraine Toussaint has popped up in lots of different shows, including Orange is the New Black. She's a very well-known black character actor. And I realized I've been seeing this a lot lately, where white characters, particularly white affluent characters, are, you know, trying to fix their lives and find themselves in therapy or in counseling of some sort. And often now, I'm seeing more and more of these therapists and counselors being played by black women.
Yeah, talk about some of the other shows where you've seen this trend popping up.
For sure. You see it on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. The lead character there, Rebecca, her doctor, Dr. Noelle Okopian, is played by Michael Hyatt. And she actually has a slightly bigger role, I think, than a lot of these therapists do. She's a recurring character, and she even has a couple of musical numbers in the show. That Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is a musical. We've also seen it in a recent season, the last season of Broad City, where Alana realizes she gets very, very upset because she can no longer orgasm, and so she goes to see a sex therapist, and that sex therapist is also played by a black woman. We've also seen it on everything from You're the Worst to also Mr. Robot And as I also mentioned in the piece, we also see it within the indie movie Band-Aid, in which Retta, who most people will probably recognize from Parks and Rec, she shows up for one scene at the very beginning as the lead character's marriage therapist. So they're kind of all over the place. And to me, it sort of signals a sort of replacement, or if not a replacement, an outgrowth of the Black best friend character that Black women and Black men have often played within pop culture over the last few decades.
Right. And you write that the Black best friend trend was so common that there were parodies of it. I've also seen parodies of the magical Black character that appears in a white person's life to give them sage wisdom and advice. What does this all mean?
Well, it really comes down to, I think, so often Black characters, we're seeing more of its shift now, thankfully, with shows like Insecure and Atlanta. But for so long, Black characters were never really allowed to be their own full-fledged three-dimensional characters. When they did pop up, it was often as the sidekick or as the Black best friend or, as you said, the magical Negro. You can look at everything from, you know, Legend of Bagger Vance with Matt Damon and Will Smith, all these movies and TV shows where that's the case. And it really goes back even further than that, I think, to when we look at the Mammy caricature, who, you know, popped up in lots of movies, everything from the Shirley Temple movies. Gone with the Wind is probably the most significant example, with Hattie McDaniel playing her character is actually named Mammy. And it really, it all kind of embodies this idea that Black women especially are caretakers of white America. And they have been since slavery, where Black women were the ones who had to birth their own children, but then also take care of the master and Mrs. Children. And oftentimes the Black women were there more nurturing and more maternal than the actual white mothers of these children. And today we now often see women of color who are nannies and have to play that role of being a service or a caretaker for white people. Now, I think the difference between that and what we see now with these like Black therapists roles, the similarity is that they are there to serve the sole purpose of helping these white characters figure out their lives, to fix their lives. And in that way, they are very much in the same vein as the Mammy character. If they may not be caring for them physically in the same way, they're not, you know, tending to their laundry or making food for them, but they are the emotional burden and saddled with that emotional burden and taking that on. Now, at the same time, the difference is that when you think of a therapist or a counselor, they're going to be making much more money than hopefully than a nanny would in the present day. And obviously the Mammy characters, they were just there. They were not making money. That was their job. So it's more of it's out of not necessity, we can say that these characters exist. They're not playing these roles because they need this job. And this is all that's afforded to them. But at the same time, it still feels a little icky because they are there for the sole purposes of helping these white characters. And I wish that it could kind of expand and we could see more than just that being taken on.
We're talking to Aisha Harris from Slate, talking about the roles that Black women play in pop culture, TV and movies. The latest trend she's seeing is Black women as the therapist figure for white characters in movies. And Aisha, let's pick up on that last point you made. What kind of representation would you like to see, and are you seeing at least some of it in more recent pop culture?
Well, I think we're definitely seeing more of it in pop culture, and I will say that we're also seeing Black lady therapists who are tending to Black characters on other shows, and I didn't get into it too much in the piece, but there is something to be said for the fact that there is still a stigma to some extent within the Black community of seeking out therapy, and so seeing it on different shows like the remake of She's Gotta Have It, which was on Netflix, the lead character there has a Black woman therapist, and I think that character has a little bit more more agency and more going on than these other characters do when they're servicing white characters. Same thing with Insecure. But I do think it's funny. I feel like we've gotten to the point now where, you know, a lot of people brought this up after I wrote the piece, that it feels like a sort of outgrowth, especially of the Oprah effect and the way in which Oprah has positioned herself as this sort of very sage, wise woman who white women especially can really latch on to. And it's, I feel like maybe there's a little bit of that subconsciously happening here. And I would love to see more of something like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, where the black lady therapist there, she actually on occasion gets to sort of have her own moments and have her own moments outside of the lead character who she is, outside of her lead character patient. And so seeing more of that and just seeing less of the black best friend would be great to see.
Right, because it sounds like whatever the role, even if we say, okay, yeah, this is a therapist with an advanced degree, that's good representation. But if it ends up being a stock character without a separate life of their own, that's where you're starting to have problems with this, it sounds like.
Exactly. Like, I'm not even complaining about the fact that they are playing these roles, because believe me, these are a step up from being a mammy or just being the black best friend. But it would be nice for that, like, let's see them outside of their office. They don't always have to be wielding a pen or a notepad and listening to their patient's problems. And I think You're the Worst is probably one of the more offensive versions of this, just because the character played by Samira Wiley, we often see her outside of the office from her patient, but then her patient pops up and interrupts her life. It's like a running gag, and she's interrupting her life, and it's demanding therapy sessions on her own time. And then she like just gives into it, and it's just like this woman doesn't even get her own life when she's living her own life. So I would love to see less of that and more expansion and three dimensionality.
We'll leave it there, Aisha. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Aisha Harris is a culture writer for Slate. She hosts their Represent podcast. She was with us to talk about a growing trend of black women playing therapists in TV shows and what that means for how black women are represented in pop culture. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency says it's going to dial back Obama-era fuel efficiency standards for new vehicles. Those rules would have ultimately required automakers to produce a fleet of cars that averaged at least 50 miles per gallon by the year 2025. Yesterday, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said that the corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE, standards went too far.
As you know, I'm here to announce that those standards that were set, that we are obligated to evaluate, I am determining that those standards are inappropriate and should be revised.
The rules were enacted in 2012 when gas was more than $4 a gallon. It started taking effect with the 2017 model year. They're going to be ramped up until 2025 under the original plan. A deal between President Barack Obama and nearly every major automaker holds CAFE rules in place through the 2021 models. The move also sets the stage for a legal showdown between the EPA and the state of California, which has been allowed to set its own air pollution standards that a dozen other states also follow. Michelle Krebs is an executive analyst for Cox Automotive's Auto Trader. Michelle, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, happy to be here.
Well, Michelle, I remember back when these rules came into effect, and for years leading up to it, CAFE, these corporate average fuel economy standards, were a hot topic of debate. Can you talk about what the current plan on the table would have done a little more?
Well, go back to 2012. The EPA set a goal that each manufacturer's cars and light trucks would average 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. And that would have meant that every car would get 54.5 miles per gallon. It would be more probably in the range of 35 or something like that. But it would have, the whole fleet would have been included. But within that, there was a provision that there would be a review in 2017. When the Obama administration left office, they said no need for a review. We'll just move ahead. President Trump came into office. He said, oh, no, we're going to reevaluate. And that had to be done by April 1st. And so that happened. And now we've been told there will be a rollback. Now, interestingly, we don't know what the rollback will be. There have been no numbers tied to this rollback.
Right. All we know is that the numbers as ruled by the EPA now would be too strict. We don't know to what extent they would be dialed back.
Right, and we're supposed to find that out at some point, but we don't know that yet. So, go ahead.
Now, looking at the standards as they were, was there a sense in the auto industry and from people who watch the industry that, hey, maybe this was too tall an order? This is going to be hard to get an entire fleet of Fords or GM or whatever manufacturer to that 50-plus miles per gallon marker?
Well, I think a couple things. So if we think back to 2012, and you said this in your intro, gasoline was much more expensive. And I believe the thinking was that the prices would continue to go up. Well, things have changed in the world. That we have a whole different world of oil production. We're producing a lot ourselves. Prices have actually gone really low. They've edged up lately, but still relatively low. And also the car makers have done a fantastic job of getting the fuel economy in regular vehicles much better. So I think the worlds were very different. And also during that time period, we have also seen a lot of focus globally on climate change. And of course there was the Paris Accord. And so there is a global effort to reduce emissions and improve fuel economy and go off, in many cases, go off petroleum altogether. And I don't see that trend will change. I think that what the automakers were looking for is some flexibility within that. Maybe certain things could be spread out in time, and that may be what they get. They'd also hoped for a single standard across the country and not having certain exceptions with various states.
Let's talk about that now, because that's part of the story that, I'll be honest, I got confused by. What's going on with the California part of this story?
California has always set its own standards. They got a special waiver, excuse me, under the Clean Air Act many years ago. And so they've always had higher standards. They also, a lot to do with the pollution in the Los Angeles area, of course. And they had laid out even stricter standards going forward to 2025. I think what the automakers really were hoping for is some reconciliation between California and the rest of the country. And then California, there are about a dozen states that also follow the lead of California. And California and those states represent a third of all of the new vehicle sales in the country. So it cannot be ignored. So now what the Trump administration has said is that they may eliminate that waiver. I don't know. I'm not a legal expert. I don't know if that's possible, but it is very clear we're set up for a legal fight.
Michelle Krebs is with us, executive analyst for Cox Automotive's Auto Trader. We're talking about the EPA saying it's going to dial back fuel efficiency standards for cars, the ones passed under the Obama administration. We asked you on Facebook, do you think that fuel efficiency standards should be kept the same, decreased, or increased? We heard from Camille there, who says, how about someone builds an affordable green car that is functional? And Michelle, that's been an issue raised with these standards that, okay, we can raise these raise fuel economy, but it's going to cost you, and it might cost consumers when they go and try to buy a new car. Is that part of the argument here?
And that is part of the argument. I think it's the biggest issue is there really isn't consumer demand for these vehicles yet. If you look at electric vehicles, which they represented last year 0.6% of all new cars sold in America, which was 17.1 million last year. If you even add that in with hybrids, plug-in hybrids, other alternative powertrains, it's less than 3%, and actually that group was down from where it had been before. So we really need to figure out how do we generate consumer demand. Now, some of it is, as your listener pointed out, there haven't been many affordable alternatives. You know, it started with Tesla with very expensive cars. It's a very expensive technology. A lot of research goes into it. We're starting to see some vehicles that are reasonably priced, like more normal vehicles. Chevrolet just came out with the Chevrolet Bolt that's around that $30,000 range. Nissan Leaf is in that range. The other thing is, since the 2012 standards were proposed, the buyers in the U.S. have shifted away from traditional cars and 2 sport utility vehicles and trucks. So the consumer preference for cars are not there, and yet the electric vehicles tend to be cars. We will see sport utility vehicles that are electric going forward in the future. And then there's the issue of infrastructure for charging.
We also heard from Deb on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb says, keep making the requirements tighter and put more constraints on manufacturers to produce cars less dependent on oil. And that was one of the arguments for CAFE standards. Michelle, is that right? That if we have these standards in place, it's going to spark innovation as companies try to meet these needs. They'll solve these problems. Eventually, the costs are going to come down.
It has. There has been a lot of innovation. There's been a lot of innovation on regular gasoline engines, but everybody in the world is working on batteries. The challenge with batteries, they're expensive, they're big, there's a big effort to figure out ways to make them smaller but be more powerful so you can have longer range. It's not a lack of effort. If someone had a breakthrough, we would have known about it by now because they would have made a fortune. It just hasn't happened. And to your listener's point, okay, the car companies can make them. Who will buy them? Because people are not buying them now.
We are talking about fuel economy standards in cars. Michelle Krebs is with us, executive analyst for Cox Automotive's Auto Trader. EPA says we're going to dial back fuel economy standards passed in the Obama era. New numbers? We don't know yet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about stricter fuel economy standards for new vehicles? Are they necessary to spur innovation and clean technologies and help the environment? Or were they too high, unrealistically high, potentially bad for consumers and for businesses? And do you want more fuel-efficient cars? Do you want them to be cars or larger vehicles? Tell us your own consumer story when it comes to cars and fuel efficiency. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the EPA's move to dial back Obama-era fuel efficiency standards on new vehicles, those scheduled to ramp up to 2025. New numbers still in the works. Michelle Krebs is with us, executive analyst for Cox Automotive's Auto Trader. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your opinions. What do you think of this announcement from the EPA? Should we be trying to dial up fuel economy over the next 7 years? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Steve is with us in Stoughton. Steve, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. First of all, I just want to say I think it's very short-sighted for the Trump administration and the EPA to roll back the CAFE standards. And on a personal level, I'm all in on the electric car. And my personal experience, and I just think people have not, people just don't know this, to operate an electric car in today's world with a power gen, electric generation being cleaner and cleaner and cleaner, it's 50% of the CO2 emissions of a gas-powered car, and my electric costs, my fuel costs, are about a third of what it would be if I had a gas car. And finally, the operating costs are basically nothing. So it's a very, while the initial cost might be high, the ongoing costs are really, really low.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Michelle,
Well, Steve raises a great point. That is true, and I think one of the big jobs we have to do going forward is educate people about electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, that kind of thing. And Steve will have a lot more choices in the future, because one of the things I would like to add is that despite the fact that the EPA is saying it's going to roll back the standards, the automakers are marching forward. They see the writing on the wall, and besides, their plans are set in place. General Motors has said we're staying the course that we had planned, you know, as if it were the same standards for 2025. They're going to introduce 20 new electric vehicles by 2023. Ford is investing $11 billion over the next 4 years to bring 40 new electric, hybrid, plug-in hybrid models. In fact, Ford showed us their lineup the other day, and every sport utility vehicle will have a hybrid or plug-in hybrid option, and they've got electric vehicles in the works that I can't talk about. Even the big Ford F-150 pickup truck will have the option for a hybrid powertrain. So they see the way the rest of the world is going. But, you know, Steve raises a great point. We are creatures of habit. We're used to just bopping into the gas station, topping it off, and going on our merry way. But if this will take a little change. And here in the Midwest, we don't have a great infrastructure for charging yet either. So that's got to come.
Steve, thanks for that call. Go next to Mark in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Yeah, to echo the information about the Ford and the pickup truck, I won't buy a pickup truck because they get horrible gas mileage. And how many times do you actually load a pickup truck full? And the body mass of a pickup truck when it's empty is not very heavy, and so it's not really that difficult to put the kind of a powertrain like what's in the car that I'm driving, which is the Toyota Prius. You can put that drivetrain into virtually any vehicle. They drive semis with it. They drive locomotive trains with it. So the whole infrastructure that we have right now for gasoline may be the limiting factor, but the fact is that I can drive like a maniac and still get 37 miles to the gallon in this car. And anytime I really need to haul something, all I got to do is lay the seats down, and I can put almost, I can put 3.5 to 4 foot wide lumber in the back of the car and close the hatchback.
All right, Mark, but drive careful, though. No driving like a maniac out there. Michelle, he's saying, hey, the technology that we're seeing in these cars, it can translate into trucks, as you were kind of just pointing out yourself.
Well, it will, but I'm sorry, but a Toyota Prius can't do what a Ford F-150 can do. I mean, many people need pickup trucks for work, and, you know, Prius isn't going to cut it. But, and I would say, you know, the current, if you compare pickup truck mileage today with what it was even 10 years ago, there's been vast improvement. There's been a lot of, you know, Ford's using aluminum to lighten up the vehicles, but and it's going to take a lot of batteries to move a size of a pickup truck. So it's coming. It'll happen.
But you say hybrids probably first, not full electric when it comes
to
trucks.
Right.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Michelle Krebs is with us from Cox Automotive's Auto Trader. Talk about fuel economy standards. The EPA saying we're going to roll back plans that were in the works to really raise average fuel economy in the country by 2025. We don't know what new targets would be. Back to your calls. Aaron is on the line in Eagle River. Aaron, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Aaron?
Well, I think that we continue to buy vehicles that get poor gas mileage because the price of gas in America is kept artificially low for many reasons, but mainly through subsidies to giant corporations that continue to make huge profits. If we did what Europe did and internalized the cost of the cleanup of the pollution caused by internal combustion engines into the cost of gasoline, I think those higher prices would drive people to buy cars that are much more fuel efficient.
Aaron, thanks for that call. And Michelle, Europe, a very different approach. Most European countries, a very different approach to gas taxes than the U.S.
Oh, right. I mean, Europe always, I mean, that's why diesel engines were so popular until the Volkswagen debacle. You're taxed on the size of the engine and such. But Europe is moving to, it will be moving to electric as well. The other country that will be a huge force in this is China, which is going to regulate. They need to because of their air quality. They will be demanding electric vehicles going forward. And, you know, they can do that kind of regulation. We aren't the same kind of society. But, you know, one of the concerns I have, too, is that China becomes, and they have made it very clear this is what they want to do, they want to be the global center of excellence for electric vehicle development. And that would put us at a disadvantage. If you think about we're rolling back and China's regulating towards EVs, if you're a company investing, where would you invest your money? You'd invest it in China where you're guaranteed a very, I mean, it's the largest car market in the world, but also the largest EV market and growing.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Adam on the line in Eau Claire. Adam, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Adam?
I do have an example that I thought was kind of intriguing. I drive a pickup truck pretty much every day for work and for personal life. And the last several vehicles I've purchased diesel vehicles. And it used to be that you were buying a premium option that got you more fuel efficiency and power economy, whatever you want to call it. And something interesting happened. In 2007, you saw an EPA mandate came out, and all of a sudden now all the manufacturers have to comply and be able to operate on ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel. And that was done in the name of clean air and an EPA mandate, I understand. But the reality is when the rubber hit the road, now all of a sudden you've got a vehicle that you're paying a premium for in the name of performance or economy, whatever we're talking about. And then they laden it with all of this emissions equipment, which it did a few things. The biggest thing is it was a big detriment to fuel economy. And then reliability is the other thing. Now you've got a whole other gamut of systems that need to be maintained on an already very expensive vehicle. And you go back to the fuel economy question. So, yes, that vehicle is operating perhaps cleaner. The emissions are cleaner. However, you're consuming significantly more fuel to achieve that. So, really, what are you gaining? Yes, it's cleaner, but you're utilizing a lot more resources to gain the same thing. So,
Adam, I want to jump in and bring Michelle on this. This is I hadn't heard about this, Michelle. Is that a story you've been following?
Yes, and you know what really was the icing on the cake is, I mean, as he points out, there's a lot of different kinds of extra catalytic converters on diesel engines because they tend to be dirtier in certain elements, and that's where the Volkswagen problem came in. No one could figure out how they were doing it without this equipment, and we found out they weren't. They were cheating on it, so. That has really set the diesel development back. I think we'll see diesel engines on trucks, but not much else. And, you know, I don't know how much development will go on there to improve them in that way.
Adam, thanks for that call. As we start to wrap up, Michelle, it sounds like some of what you said, because of the international market, because of current existing plans at automakers, even if we change and we don't impose these stricter standards by 2025, that's not necessarily going to change the direction of the technology.
Right. I think we're on a path. It may be not as fast as some want. We may not hit like certain timing elements that were there before. But this is a global movement, and if you're a global automaker, you've got to be focused in that direction of a cleaner, possibly EV future. And when we start talking about driverless cars, those most likely will be electric vehicles. And that's a whole other subject.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Michelle Krebs, executive analyst for Cox Automotive's Auto Trader. We talked to her about the EPA's plans to undo Obama-era fuel efficiency standards for new vehicles. Those plans were just being phased in, starting with last year's models and ramping up to 2025. Still up in the air, what new targets, what new numbers might be. Still time for you to share your thoughts. There's a lively conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can see what other people around the state are saying and weigh in yourself.